Good morning. Please be seated. This is the time for oral arguments for the Southern panel. The first case on our docket today is case 76621. I hope I pronounced this correctly, Joshua Honea versus the state. Are you ready to go, Mr. MacArthur?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, the state ready? Okay. There'll be no response, and there was no reply brief filed, so you'll have 15 minutes, Mr. MacArthur.
Am I allowed to ask
reserve
any time?
No.
Understood, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, the gallery, and the persons present, including Appellant Honan, who's present out of custody on an appeal bond granted by Judge Delaney when she denied our motion for new trial. I am Jonathan MacArthur, counsel for the appellant. Before you is a case that reflects a compromised verdict rendered by a compromised jury. There are three issues submitted for your review. First, a failure to properly instruct the jury. Second, jury misconduct of the extrinsic variety. And third, sufficiency of the evidence. Beginning with the jury instructions, these are reviewed under harmless and error analysis. Failure to properly instruct a jury on an element of defense is not harmless error and requires reversal here for that reason. NRS 200.366, which has been amended since the events alleged in this case, have two sections, A and B. A pertains to sexual assault of a minor under the age of 16, and B is minor under the age of 14, both of which were left here. However, in relevant part, A makes it clear that consent or knowledge where the defendant knew or should have known that the complainant could not consent is an issue. However, that same language is absent from the second section under 14, making it clear that if there is sexual penetration of a 14-year-old, it does not matter if it's consensual, that is not part of the analysis, it is sexual assault. However, for over 14, but under 16, there is consent language. And this is important because a plain reading also introduces another statute, statutory sexual seduction, what makes it illegal to sexually penetrate an individual by between the ages of 14 and 16. If it is not consensual, it is sexual assault. If it is consensual and the actor is over the age of 18 for a gross misdemeanor or 21 for a felony, that would be statutory sexual seduction. Now, this court was required, and I'm sorry, not this court, but the district court was required to give a consent instruction per our theory of the case. Consent was a defense to sexual assault of which the defendant was facing 42 separate counts. Now, we did not expect that we were not going to get a consent instruction. And in the milieu of trial, when we tried to find a case that was specifically on point, what we should have done is cited to Carter v. State, 121 Nevada 759-762, where the Nevada Supreme Court en banc confirmed through Judge Maupin, Honeycutt, and established that a consent instruction is an element that is required. Now, at trial, we did not, it's important to note that we did not request statutory sexual seduction to be included on the verdict form. There are three important reasons for this. One is that the state had the discretion to choose how this case was charged. They could have charged statutory sexual seduction as an alternate count to any of the sexual assaults and chose not to do that. We were not interested in providing an off-ramp that gave the jury an opportunity to compromise. The state would have to prove sexual assault and lack of consent, and failing to do that, the defendant was entitled to an acquittal. Number two, statutory sexual seduction is a lesser related offense, not a lesser included offense, and so I do not believe that we would have been entitled to it. And then lastly, there was circumstantial evidence abundantly from the trial that Mr. Honea and the complaining witness knew each other, that they were friendly, that they became affectionate toward each other, had an affinity, and discussion of whether they could actually be in a full-blown relationship. There was a possibility that the jury might find that there had been sexual contact, but if they did so, that it would have been consensual, and because that did not meet one of the elements, would also have resulted in acquittal. Now, with that said, we did provide a proposed negatively worded jury instruction to the effect that if the state failed to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, the lack of consent on the part of MS, that the defendant was entitled to an acquittal. However, the state objected arguing that since 2015 that consent was no longer an issue in sexual assault of a minor under 16. We disagreed. The court, however, was persuaded and denied our proposal. Now, at sentencing, the court had learned that Deputy District Attorney Lisa Lucich had made an opposite argument just a couple of departments away, where she argued that consent was an element of sexual assault under the age of 16. That is when the appellate bond was granted. Failure to properly instruct a jury on an element of an offense is not harmless error and requires reversal here for that reason. Moving forward to the issue of juror misconduct. There was egregious misconduct by jurors that undermined fundamental fairness in this trial, requiring reversal. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion and clear error. Because the type of juror misconduct we're talking about is extrinsic, this court is to apply a de novo review. Now, the burden of proof is established under Meyer v. State and requires two things. First, the occurrence of juror misconduct. Secondly, that the misconduct was prejudicial and likely would have affected the decision-making of a reasonable, hypothetical juror. Now, we had two separate instances of extrinsic juror misconduct in this case, by jurors number one and number three. I'll speak first on number one. The actual evidence, which is documented in the affidavits of other jurors, is that juror number one consulted a media source. We know that he consulted at least one, and that it was the Las Vegas Review-Journal in an article known as Teen Drops Bomb on State's Case. Now, we do not know if that is the only source that he consulted. When we asked for an evidentiary hearing, that was denied by Judge Delaney, who had found that the article was neutral and unlikely to have impacted their thinking. However, while we can document the extrinsic influence, we were obstructed from documenting the prejudice, and therefore we are forced to do that circumstantially. First, juror number one and juror number three, right now we're talking about one, but the two of them, both were heard to say by other jurors, we need to convict Tonea of something. Number two, juror number one was heard to say by juror number 11 that Stacy and Christina, referring to the prosecutors, did not have their thing together and that they did not do their jobs, so we will have to do their jobs for them. This is a disturbing displacement of the juror's role as a neutral fact finder. Juror number one invited the rest of the jurors to act as substitute prosecutors because they felt as though the case had not been adequately prepared.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, ma'am.
In that regard. Don't we have to distinguish those two situations? One is clearly occurring within the deliberations, which under the circumstances you described, we may not be permitted to reach what happens in the deliberations. The other deals with extrinsic evidence and whether or not the juror did research and then whether or not the juror shared that information with the other jurors. Don't we have to kind of separate out those two types of what could be considered juror misconduct?
If I understand the court's question correctly, we would have had to have an evidentiary hearing in order to establish the prejudice with regard to what information juror number one had that he believed that the state neglected to present. And while that was something that was discussed in deliberation, that information was a result of extrinsic influence, namely his looking up the article and his contacts with juror three, who I have not yet talked about. But because the origin is extrinsic influence, the fact that it makes it into the deliberation, I think, is a bit of surplusage. It's almost like the fruit of the poisonous tree. If the external influence that is impacting the fairness of the proceedings then goes in to affect the deliberations, I don't think that our inquiry should stop just because it's now in deliberation. If it happened outside of deliberation, it is still relevant and so should have been ordered. Did that answer the question?
Sure.
Thank you, ma'am. Moving forward, after having stated that the state did not do its job, the verdict came back as guilty on count 39, seemingly chosen at random from 20 other counts that alleged the exact same circumstances involving the same people in the same time frame. The jury, interestingly, per juror number four, was split, 7-favor at this point, in favor of guilt. We don't know on how many counts or which counts she may have been talking about.
On count 39, offhand, do you know how old she would have been on count 39, i.e., was she 15 versus 13?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there something in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Count 39 was for conduct alleged to have occurred between ages of 14 and 16, and they provided essentially almost a 2-year mode of opportunity, but it was clearly from the batch of sexual assaults that were between 14 and 16. He was not convicted on any of the counts that were alleged under the age of 14.
Did the record show the date of the Carl Chan visit?
I believe the record does. I do not have that information in front of me.
And would she have been between 14 and 16 at the time of the Carlsbad visit?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, the reason why the 7-5 split in favor of guilt is important is that it mirrors the same split in the Canada v. State decision, where this court characterized the 5 people as a strong contingent to acquit. That circumstance was identical here. Moving forward to juror number 3. This was the inverse. Originally on juror number 1, we were able to document the conduct, but we were stopped from documenting the prejudice. In this instance, we were allowed or able to document the prejudice, but we were stopped from documenting the actual misconduct. The defense, after trial, investigated and learned that the recanting witness, M.S., had a real-world friend with the initials T.J., and that T.J. was juror number 3's biological sister. This was not known to defense counsel at any point during the trial and was found afterward. Now, we were not allowed to have an evidentiary hearing where we could establish whether or not juror number 3 had talked to his sister about her friend MS prior to trial. However, we were able to document circumstantially the evidence of extrinsic influence. Despite an ongoing duty, juror number 3 never advised the court or the parties that his sister was friends with MS in the real world. This also mirrors the Canada decision. Now, I know that it's important under Lopez, and I know that Judge Stiglitz would recognize this, whether or not he may have forgotten that or been unaware of it, or whether or not it was intentional. However, we were stopped from being able to make that inquiry because there was no evidentiary hearing. In any case, we would have challenged such a juror for cause or dismissed him on a peremptory challenge if at any point in voir dire we had become aware that he had a second-degree connection to the complaining witness. And all of this happens in the background of knowing that our district courts, every time a jury leaves the room, reads them the same admonition that they are not to consult the media, that they are not to discuss the facts of the case with other third parties, that they are not to render a decision or come to a conclusion before the conclusion of the evidence. This is read every single time, and he still did not bring this fact to our attention. We know from the other jurors, namely jurors number 4 and 7, that juror number 1 and 3 had lunch alone together during the last week of trial. We also know that juror number 3 was in the coalition with juror number 1, with whom he was sharing lunch, that wanted to convict Hane of something, which they literally did. The prejudice is evident because neither party presented a theory that would have justified finding a guilty finding on only one count. Either a lot of things happened or it did not happen, depending on which testimony you believe. There was not a scenario in which it only happened once. Both of these instances were extrinsic, not intrinsic, and should have been given an evidentiary hearing. Pursuant to that, Meyer and Canada presents the factors that the court should have considered. That is, misleading answers at voir dire, third-party contact with jurors, independent research, how long it was discussed, and when it may have been discussed. We were stopped from being able to receive these answers.
Can I answer your question?
Yes, ma'am.
Was there anything to distinguish count 39 from other counts? For instance, there was no different corroborative evidence or physical evidence or anything else to distinguish 39 from any of the other charges?
That is absolutely correct. Had we had an evidentiary hearing, we would have wanted to determine
how many other counts. Mr. McArthur, could I ask you another question?
I'm sorry.
Did you, do you have a record cite to the proffered jury instruction you referenced earlier?
I do not have it in my my notes, I can find it.
Give it to the clerk after you're,
yes, sir,
after we're finished. Thank you. I'd like to get that record cited.
I will do that, Your Honor.
Thank you. And this is the negative.
Word of instruction.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think it would be worthwhile for you to talk about instruction 39 in the remaining time you have, please. Count 39, my apologies, and the sufficiency of the evidence to support that count.
All right, Your Honor. Count 39 was one of 52 counts. There were two groups of 20. One was sexual assault on a minor under the age of 14. There were approximately 21 of those. And there were 20 counts of sexual assault on a minor under 16, of which 39 fell into that group. This coerced verdict did not rely on any of the pure evidence supporting the charge. There was no evidentiary basis for the conviction. While the state did introduce evidence that she had, MS had testified in her police report and in a preliminary hearing, this was refuted by MS and not just categorically denied, but she provided information on, this is why I was angry at the defendant, this is how I developed the information, this is who I practiced my narrative with, and ultimately, this is the true information that I tied it to in order to make it look legitimate.
Okay, thank you, sir. Ms. Collins?
Good morning, Justice. Stacey Collins on behalf of the state. Thank you for your time today. I'd like to start with count 39. There actually is evidence in the record to corroborate count 39. There was a trip by Mr. Honea and MS to Carlsbad, California, where intercourse, fellatio, and cunnilingus took place.
That was
Intercourse, cunnilingus, and fellatio took place, which would have been counts 39, 40, 41, I believe. And there are pictures from that trip to Carlsbad, California. There are pictures of MS. There are pictures of the defendants there together in California.
Well, you're saying that there is three counts of sexual assault based on cunnilingus, fellatio, and intercourse. They came back not guilty on two of them, but guilty on one of them. And which one was the one?
Intercourse, Your Honor.
Okay.
There was also a room receipt, is that correct?
Excuse me?
There was also a room receipt for Carlsbad?
Yes, there was. There was also a room receipt. Yes, there was. Thank you.
Were there other counts didn't have any other corroboration other than the verbal? Like such as this is so distinguishable?
There were some tickets to Disneyland. There were some other photographs, but those photographs were mostly in Las Vegas. Some of them were with family members. I know there was pictures from the defendant's birthday party when he turned 21, but those contained pictures of family members that were also included in the celebration, if I remember correctly.
Did they have pictures of Carlsbad as well? Of them in Carlsbad?
Okay.
No, I'm talking about those two in Carlsbad on your trip.
Yes, yes. That was my disagreement with Mr. MacArthur's statement, was those photographs of them alone in Carlsbad corroborated that count.
And what were those? Do you have the exhibit numbers on those photographs?
I do not, but I can supply them for you.
And do you remember if they were entered in through MS's testimony or with somebody else who's maybe discovered them where we could find those?
I believe they were entered through MS.
Okay.
I believe they were entered through MS.
Thank you.
Next, just kind of going backwards, if I could discuss the prejudice about the juror misconduct. I really want to start with the content of that article that the appellant says has...
Before you do that, could you also address one other question on the sufficiency of the evidence?
Certainly.
Am I correct that MS recanted all three circumstances under counts 39, 40, and 41.
MS gave a blanket recant of everything that she had previously told police, that she had previously testified to under oath, any information that she gave us during pretrial conferences. It was a blanket recant. And her recant started with, we got in a fight, and I did this to get back at him at the beginning of the trial. She didn't know what the fight was about. That evolved during trial to something about Josh losing his virginity. That's why she turned him in. And then there was yet another third excuse. So she gave a blanket recant for everything.
Would she have been between 14 and 16 at the Carlsbad? How old was she during that?
She was sort of...
I mean, you know when the date was on Carlsbad if you have the hotel receipt. So what would her age have been based on that hotel receipt?
She would have been 14.
14?
Yes.
Okay.
Would you like any more information on the sufficiency?
Well, it is odd that the jury would reject counts 40 and 41 and convict on 39 when they are all incidences associated with the exact same trip.
You know, I absolutely agree.
We're not in a position to second-guess the jury, and, of course, under the standard of review, we need to treat the facts in a light most favorable to the state. But this is an issue where the corroboration, I think there's ample corroboration of the trip. I'm concerned about whether there's adequate corroboration or sufficiency of evidence to demonstrate the criminal act.
And I can tell you this. From the inception of MS's disclosure, this started in 2011 mm-hmm. when she was 11 years old. And she had been groomed by this defendant over a course of time. She gave a very coherent story and recitation of all the efforts defendant took to get her to eventually have sex during the first summer of 2011, right after he turned 18, how he pressured her for sex, how sex for them was incompatible for a period of time because of her physical size, how he was controlling over her, how eventually they did come to have sex. She gave very descriptive evidence about...
And all of that formed the basis for these substantial counts. And all of it was rejected except one, the Carlsbad trip, by the jury.
Well, for instance, she described being taken to the...
I guess the point I'm raising, without deciding, of course, is her entire story, essentially, with one limited example talking about multiple instances, appears to have been rejected by the jury.
That is correct. And I can tell you that a lot of this is because these crimes do occur in secret, and they're not documented. We don't have photographs of them in the car together.
I appreciate that.
So when we have photographs of them alone in Carlsbad, that gave them something to hang their head on, that they actually traveled there and that this actually happened. I mean, her story from beginning to end is very linear and cogent, and I know you've read the facts, but there is corroboration for that count. And, you know, I can't tell you why they did what they did. You know, it was a trial that went between the day after Thanksgiving to right before Christmas. It went much longer than they anticipated.
Mr. MacArthur's theories in his briefing and his argument here today is that the verdict was the product of trying to find the defendant guilty of something. As opposed to, that's all speculation, I think, but it does go to the other two points he raises on appeal, which I should give you time to address, which is the instruction question and then the juror misconduct question.
I'm going to start with the juror misconduct.
Okay.
That article that juror read was nothing but quotes from Mr. MacArthur. It was how the state received unanticipated evidence and testimony. It did not inure to the defendant's detriment. It did not prejudice him at all. If it did anything, it gave the defense theory in, like, media litigation, if you will.
But why not give an evidentiary hearing? This is a life sentence. Even one count is a life sentence, life at 20.
That's right.
Why not give an evidentiary hearing when you're looking at possible juror misconduct in a case?
As it applies to reviewing the article?
And whatever else with the Facebook. But why not just for the record? Because once a district court makes findings, then we're stuck with those findings. But here, there's not even an evidentiary record, evidentiary hearing. And generally, when we have juror misconduct cases, there is an evidentiary hearing to go into the juror misconduct.
So, in terms of the tenuous Facebook friendship, I don't think that juror even knew that his friend.
You're speculating now. Wouldn't it be for the district courts? Because we're making law for all of Nevada.
Yes, ma'am.
So when there is juror misconduct, why are the district courts not giving an evidentiary hearing when significant, you're looking at a life sentence? Why? Why not? It takes 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half hour to make a record and show that they're, all right, so it happened, but this didn't affect the verdict.
There is a record about the article. The article was submitted as an exhibit. The court reviewed it, agreed that there was no prejudice to the defendant for that. In terms of calling in the juror about his sister's alleged friendship, even if she was friends, what would the prejudice be? Because he was only convicted of one count.
Ms. Collins, yeah, I want to piggyback on what Justice Silver's asking about the article.
Yes.
So the allegation wasn't that the juror brought the article into the room, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
It was that he relayed that he read an article.
Correct.
So the article doesn't really inform our conversation, because the real question is, how did the juror characterize the article in the jury room, which is what we don't know. Like, you can read the article, but unless he handed that out, our analysis of whether this article is prejudicial or whatnot doesn't really matter, because it matters what the juror said to the other jurors when they read the article, like, oops, prosecution really messed up, I read this article, or was it just the facts? I mean, we just don't know.
So we don't know.
Uh-huh.
And I guess my response to that is, if the degradation was against the prosecution, I don't think that's prejudice to the defendant. I mean, if it's that we didn't do our job and that it was a surprise to us that she was going to recant, I don't see how that prejudices him. I see how it prejudices the state, which has no recourse, honestly, but I don't see how it prejudices him, but maybe
Well, again, you're adopting maybe my statements about what the juror may have said. I don't know. We don't know what the juror said.
Understood. I know you wanted to talk about the consent instruction. So when the defense offered their consent is a defense to sexual assault on a minor under 16, what they really should have done is at least proffered instructions that talked about consent in fact. Because if you look at Guitron, there's no argument in that case that that child consented in fact. She took actions. She approached.
She was 13 when she had the defendant's baby. She was 13. And by the way, that was her dad, and the DNA showed it was her dad.
I understand.
So she was only 13. This is like, we don't know how old during some of these acts.
She was 14 for count 39. We're talking about a kid that was the product, similar to Guitron, of being groomed all the way. From 11 through 14, 15, you know, she was under this defendant's control over a substantial, if you read the facts, mom had kind of abdicated her responsibility to this defendant, so she was groomed. And we had John Packel to substantiate that upon his review of the case. My point is, if they wanted a consent instruction, it should have been drafted differently. Because consent, just on its own, consent in fact should not be a defense to sexual assault under 16 if there are circumstances that show that she was groomed, this happened against her will, because...
So you're saying that it's up to them and not the district court if to tailor it correctly, because you didn't like the one that they gave. I mean, but basically, if they were entitled to it, they're entitled to it, and the district court should have tailored it to their defense, even if it was not what you wanted.
Well, and let's go back, if I might. Not one time during this trial did they stand up and argue consent. Their entire defense, and it's replete in their closing arguments. If you read Mr. MacArthur's closing argument, I think it's page 59, this absolutely didn't happen. Consent was never their defense.
But you objected to that instruction, so what's the point at that point for them to even say consent if that's not an instruction for the jury?
They could have asked for a reasonable belief about consent, like was given in Guitron, but their instruction was flat out, consent is a complete defense.
Guitron was Lisa Lusich's, and she actually argued statutory sexual, the defense argued statutory sexual seduction. So that was actually a lesser related, but the same judge gave it. But it was not, consent was not a proffered instruction in Guitron. I know I wrote it and I read that whole record.
No, it was, I know that. I know that you did. And the instruction I believe that was given, that is if the defendant had a reasonable belief that there was consent, then that could be a defense. But that wasn't the case.
So you're saying that even under Carter, that the consent was not their theory of the defense?
No.
Okay.
No.
When the instruction was proffered, I assume it was argued to the court.
It was, and...
And what was the... I get your point about the problem associated with the proposed or proffered instruction, but what was the court's decision in rejecting it? I don't think it was based on the fact that it was improperly worded.
Well, I think the court reviewed Manning, which says the age of consent in Nevada for sexual intercourse is 16. And reviewing that, and we offered an instruction that said consent in fact is not a defense, because even under the most liberal reading of Guitron, that young lady was alleged to have approached that defendant. And so he was allowed to argue statutory based on her consenting conduct. But
your instruction wasn't given either.
Consent in fact is not a defense was given.
All right. Any other questions by the panel?
No.
Justice Silver?
No.
All right. Ms. Wells, thank you very much.